G'day and welcome to another episode of the Luke's Lowdown podcast. And today's podcast, I've got a very, very, very special guest and I saved him for last. This is the final episode of this series of the Luke's Lowdown podcast. Oh, I know, you're all disappointed. But I have had my arm twisted to look at doing another one before the end of the year. So I have been talking to some really cool individuals already to potentially start recording to release another episode, another series, I should say, at the end of the year. But anyway, back to today's guest. I saved him for last because of two reasons. One, he's an Aussie, and we started with an Aussie in Lucy Bartholomew. So definitely go and check her episode out. And also, this man I've known for a very, very, very long time. We actually went to high school together. We were mates at school. We ran around in the same circles together and we know stuff about people that no one needs to know. And also we played soccer together. We played soccer against one another. And we sort of disconnected for a while because I moved overseas and did all that stuff. And I found him online through a mutual friend who we went to school with as well, and found out that this guy who I've known for a long time is winning ultra marathons, podium at some big races, and also was crowned the Australian Backyard Ultra Champion. That's right. Today, we have Chris Murph Murphy on the podcast today, and he's an Australian ultra runner from up north Queensland. Murphs, how are you, buddy?
Good, brother. How you doing?
Mate, I'm good. It's great to chat with you.
Yeah, you do. You make me feel kind of special there, man.
Mate, you are special. You are. As I said, we lost sort of contact a bit for a while there. You know, life happens, moving to the outside of the world. And through, you know, someone who is still a very close friend of both of ours, we'll give him a shout out, Baz. He knows who he is. I saw that, you know, you were doing some awesome things in the ultra marathon world. And yeah, it's great to connect and hear a little bit about your ultra running story.
Thanks, man. No, I've been watching some of your stuff from afar over the years, so it's always been inspiring.
Yeah. So I think it's really good to point out that, okay, yes, you're very active as a kid, you know, played soccer, played basketball, you know, really, really active, especially in the town that we grew up in Bathurst. And a lot of times people sort of gloss over their backgrounds when they do, you know, whether it's ultras or other sports as they get older. But I think your story into how you got into running is really, it really helps people understand that, hey, you know, even if you have setbacks, you can try something new or you can try something slightly different to what you've always done and you can still achieve, you know, success, whatever that means to you. So just really, really briefly, like you weren't a runner, you didn't sort of run marathons or anything and then dove into ultras. Can you just give us a really, really sort of brief version of how you got into ultra running via that first park run that you did?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, so like you said, I grew up playing soccer and basketball, baseball, whatever I could do, chasing the ball around or running around with people, I did as a kid. So it was, running was just in the background of all those sports. So it was just something you did as training for another sport. But then, yeah, once I left school, moved away, got a grown-up job and all that sort of stuff, it was sports in a team environment didn't really fit with where I was at. So I just couldn't commit to anything properly. So I couldn't play sports the way I liked to. So that sort of fell by the wayside. Busy work schedules, drinking to relax on my days off. Things went a bit, fitness went downhill, we'll put it that way. And then after a few years of that sort of lifestyle in 2014, I thought I had a bit of indigestion one night when I was visiting my sister and slept it off. It went away. And next day, bad indigestion again, which I couldn't shake. So my sister took me out to the hospital to try and get something to relieve it in the middle of the night. And they came in, closed the curtains, told me I was showing signs of a severe heart attack, wheeled me upstairs to the cardiac unit. And long story short, I had myocarditis, secondary from a flu or something I had a week before. So that really knocked me around for a couple of years by the time I had on medications and whatever to look after the body and heart. Slow process to make sure that there was no long-lasting issues and whatnot from that. And then after a couple of years of being extremely complete lack of exercise, really, because I was taking it easy on the heart as best I could, I got sick of all that and pushed the point with the doctors and that, and asked, is it okay if I start doing something to get a bit of fitness back? Can I just start running around the block? And that was also the happy with that. So I started running around the block, and then we'd do a little bit of running out at work, and a bloke out there said, oh, Ellie Beach 5K's on next month, come and do that. So I decided to do that. Went there, managed to scrape together a 5K, and then got bumped into another friend there who was into running that I didn't know about. And he said, oh, every Saturday, come down to Park Run. And he goes, just get yourself a barcode, come down every Saturday, do your thing. And then, got myself a barcode, turned up to Park Run. And to put it bluntly, it snowballed from there. that became something to a habit every Saturday. And that was the best thing I think about it, was it gave me a way of being consistent, that every week was Saturday. I want to get a little bit better. I could see my times progressing. And then once I got more comfortable with the 5K, somewhere along the line, I jumped to a half marathon. Did a couple of those, and then we had a trail run at home. So I signed up for that, which is 28Ks, and it was late November. So it was ridiculously hot, crazy humid. We had a cyclone 6 months before. So through the scrub, there was no coverage or escape from the sun, and just got absolutely cooked, just cramping up like crazy. Finished that trail race, and then for some reason, shortly after, I decided UTA 100 will be the next step. And
I love it. I think it makes sense to me.
I think Bazza might have been part of the influence in that. I've seen that he'd done it so many times before, and I'm like, oh, wow, that seems ridiculous, but Blair can do it. Maybe I can too.
Yeah, so the UTA 100 for non-Australian ultra runners and maybe people who don't follow the World Series is a 100-kilometer race. It's got around 4,500 meters of climbing, which is about 15,000 feet. It's in the Blue Mountains, which is people who are not from Australia and have gone to Sydney and they go, oh, the Blue Mountains, it's beautiful, it's amazing. Well, I don't know if you feel like this. Like, I've never ran in the Blue Mountains, so I am looking forward to doing it one day. But for growing up in Bathurst and traveling to Sydney a hell of a lot for sport, the Blue Mountains was just this annoying place that you had to drive slower because you're driving through a mountain range. So it's like I've got this love-hate relationship with the Blue Mountains, because it was like if it was just flat, I'd get to Sydney, you know, an hour quicker. Anyway, that's a random tangent. So the Ultra Trail Australia is through the Blue Mountains. It's pretty rugged. It's pretty exposed. There's a lot of really steep stairs.
Lots and lots of stairs.
Yeah. And, you know, there's some places where you're scrambling through, like, you know, two big boulders and stuff like this. So it's a brutal race, 4,500 meters of climbing. And yeah, like our mates Blair and Baz and Raz, they started it off when the first race was, I don't know, about 7 or 8 years ago. And I think Blair's done pretty much nearly all of them apart from one or two. So
7 or 8 now.
Yeah. So I think the first question to dive into there was, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but what was it like? What were you thinking mentally when you're like, I've done this 28K and you live up in northeastern Australia, which is why you're talking about cyclones and being really hot in November because you're in the southern hemisphere. What was it mentally that you're like, okay, I've done 28Ks. I've seen a mate who I've known forever. He's done these 100K races. He's done it. He survived. Like, what were you thinking like in terms of how are you going to prepare for it? What was it going to be like when you decided, yeah, I'm going to do it? Then you signed up and you got a place.
Well, when I first started running, like 5Ks seemed a ridiculously long way. When I was running it felt like it took forever to get there. And then once I got used to that, I eventually moved on to the half marathon. That seemed crazy. Like, how do people run 21Ks? And then I went and did that. And I'm like, oh, maybe I can do that. And I looked at the next step, and it was just that curiosity. How much further can I go? What's the next step, and where's it going to come to a point where I can't go more? So I was like, oh, well, I'll just keep jumping to things that seem a bit far-fetched for what I think I can do and see what happens. And then, but yeah, that day I hit the trigger on signing up for UTA, I had that deep down feeling of dread that came across me as soon as I hit that payment button. It was just, holy shit, what have I done? But that was probably a good driver while there to kick my ass into putting the proper training in. So make sure I had a half a chance.
You hit pay lots of money to get into a race to, you know, torture yourself, which we all do. Yeah. And you have that dread. How did you then shift that from, holy crap, what have I done? I've never done anything like this before. Yeah, going from 5K to half marathon looked like a big jump, but this is like five times a half marathon plus over mountains. How did you shift from that negative sort of dread, like, am I going to finish, to having the mindset that you had on race day?
Well, I suppose like a race day, I pictured I've got 6 months, 8 months, however long it was before the race started. I'm like, I've got that much time to get myself ready. I'm like, the 100Ks is a massive thing to think about. So what do I need to do over the next 6 months to get myself ready for that? And then break it down further from there. What do I need to do today that'll help me by the end of the week, by the end of next month, to be able to, by the end, get myself in a position where I might be able to do it? And just sort of, yeah, try to break it down into lots of little goals along the way. And
I think that's really important. Sorry to interrupt you there, but I think it's really important, because what you've just said, and a lot of people will hear it and go, yeah, like, you have set a big goal and you break it down and this and that. But what a lot of people will miss this, and I really want to go over it, and something that I use with a lot of my coaching clients, not just for my runners, but also in the corporate world, is you've got this massive big target. And yeah, you want to break it down to say, okay, like, how do I achieve it? But you then break it down to, okay, where do I want to be in a month? And then you break it down to, okay, what do I want to achieve this week? But then, as you said, you break it down to, what do I need to do today? And then reverse engineer that. I need to do this today to help set me up to be where I want to be at the end of the week. I need to achieve what I want to achieve by the end of this week to give me a chance to be where I need to be at the end of the month. And if I keep doing that over 8 months, I'm going to give myself a chance. So I think it's really powerful, Murph, that you were able to do that. And you know, because I sort of know, it was just sort of off the cuff, like, yeah, like, I just did this and broke it down. But I think that is a real life application of, okay, I've got a target that I want to achieve in 8 months. And we hear this thing, focus on the process, not the outcome, all the time. And I 100% agree with that. And you know, people say it's cliche, but it's only cliche if you don't do anything about it. And yep. I think what you just said is a real life, tangible way to actually focus on the process of, I want to achieve this in 8 months. So then what do I have to do today? Because that's all we can focus on today, this moment. So it's a case of, I have to go out and run. I choose to go out and run 10Ks today because that's going to help me get to where I want to be at the end of the week, at the end of the month, and in 8 months' time. So is that something that just, like, for you just made sense and came naturally, or was that something that you thought about from consciously to actually set yourself up for a chance of success?
I think it was, I think when I first signed up and had that deep feeling of dread, that I knew that was because it was such an overwhelming goal, that if I just focused on, shit, I've got to run 100Ks and that's all I thought about, then that would probably drive me insane and I'd probably avoid certain things just to because it's such a daunting sort of thing to focus on. So with my work, we work on big projects, which is a massive jobs underground, where you've got to pull pieces of equipment that are hundreds of meters long apart, move it around, put it back together. So it's, you've got to break it down to little pieces to be able to get it done and get it done right, and put the attention into the finer details along the way, so that at the end of the day, the overall project just happens as a result of doing the little pieces day by day. So it's, I suppose it's something I use elsewhere, that just found its way into what I did with my running. And obviously, it worked really well to keep me focused on what I had to do right now and not get overwhelmed with the whole situation. Well, I had days where I was like, what have I done? This is stupid. But at the end of the day, it all worked out in the end. So
yeah, exactly. I love that. This is a stupid idea. We've all been there.
Yeah. So yes.
You mentioned another word just previously, and I'm pretty sure I've said this on all 10 episodes of this series of the Luke Slowdown podcast, is something that comes up pretty much with everyone is curiosity. They're curious as to what they can achieve. They're curious as to what's it going to be if I just push that little bit further. They're curious to sort of go, well, if I don't go left, like I've always gone left, what happens if I go right?
Mm.
And I'm just finding the more people I talk with, whether it's be endurance athletes or business leaders or just people in general who are consistently doing cool stuff. I'm just going to like leave that there. Curiosity is really a driving force for them. And I'm guessing that's what sort of shot you into doing these, you know, day long, no finish line events that are the backyard ultras. So can you sort of give us a bit of a how you went from running the UTA 100 through the Blue Mountains to signing up for a race that has no finishing line?
Well, the first backyard ultra I don't even know why I had the entry. I've got an entry to run TDS over in Chamonix. So got that back for 2020. And then with all the COVID crap that went down, that got knocked off the table. So, that was gone for August, and for whatever reason, back in 2020, I was on the wait list for the Clint Eastwood, which is a backyard ultra back here, back home. And it popped up, do you want an entry? And I just ignored it. And then it popped up again, would you like an entry off the wait list? And I think I ignored it twice, and then eventually went, I'm pretty, I'm sick, curious. Because I'd heard about these things, and it just really intrigued me as to how you turn up to a race not knowing whether you're going to run for 6 hours, 12 hours, 30 hours, 58 hours, I think was about the best at the time back then. And I'm like, how do you, like, just logistically, what do you turn up with? What gear do you take? What food do you take? And that really piqued my interest in that style of event. So, I eventually took up one of the waitlist spots at the Clint Eastwood and thought, oh, it'd be a good week away. So I plan to drive down, just load it up with a ridiculous amount of food and whatnot. And I think my initial setup and plan that I gave myself to turn up to that was, I got set out about 60 hours. So it was ridiculous. But I didn't want to get there and walk away with, I had to stop because I ran out of food or something along those lines. So I made sure that I had everything sort of set up to go way longer than I think anyone had ever gone. And just turned down to have a bit of fun.
I want to dive into that because for me, I can sort of make sense of that. But okay, so you, for context, for those who don't know what we're talking about, the backyard ultras is really simple concept. Every hour on the hour, you've got to run 6.7 kilometers around the same course, the same loop, right? Or 4.1 miles. And at some races, the night you'll go and change the loop and run on the road rather than a trail, but they're all pretty much on trails. 6.7 kilometers every hour on the hour. If you don't make it, then you're out. And it's literally last person standing. So there is no finishing line. So that's for context. So at the time, you're like curious about this race. You're like, how does it even work logistically? You know, how long is it going to run for? There's been people who have done it for like 3 days is the record at the time. And you've gone, okay, well, I've got to take all my stuff with me. I'm going to prepare to run the distance, the time, the many loops that no one has ever ran before, like, you know, from the inception of these races. Like, that was obviously a conscious thought, Murphs. Where did that come from?
I think it was just that I didn't want to give myself, I knew this race was quite a mental battle once you get past a certain point. And I didn't want to give myself any excuse to pull up earlier than what I had to. So there was no distance goal. There was no time goal. There was nothing other than I wanted to go until there was no one else running. So I wanted to be last one standing. That was my thought then, was that's fantasy. But I knew with this style of event being such a mental game, and I use that word deliberately, game, that I had to give myself that as the goal. Otherwise, it'd be too easy to fall away and say, no, I'm done.
So if you, to use your words, if you believed or thought, let's say, that 60 laps, which is 60 hours, is fantasy, as you said, what did you, like in hindsight now, or even at the time, what did you believe that you potentially could be capable of going into that first Backyard Ultra?
I wasn't sure at all. My thoughts for the race was that if you can get past the 24-hour mark, start the 25th loop, then the people left in the race then are the ones that are the serious contenders. So the race begins at 25 hours. So I just wanted to be on the start line for the 25th loop and then see what happened from there.
So I'm going to dive really far forward before we come back into you becoming the Australian Backyard Ultra champion.
Yep.
And winning Backyard Ultra. And something that's recently happened, Belgian guy, Miren Gerts. Okay, so if this is not how you pronounce his name, I'm very, very sorry. But a Belgian guy, Miren Gerts, just completed 90 loops for a distance of 603 kilometers. Like, that is nearly 4 days of running 6.7 kilometers on the hour, every hour, completing it, you know, under an hour. And like, it's awesome. And there have been people who have thrown it out there. That's like, yeah, we believe the 100 loops is possible. And I'll be honest, like when I started looking into Backyard Ultras, you know, I'm sure I'll do one day. It does intrigue me.
Yeah, you should.
Not quite at the moment, but because obviously it's something that you've got to, you know, for me, and to get out of it whatever I would want to get out of it, I'd want to give myself a bit of preparation. So it will happen. And looking at it, and it's not saying that I believe I could do it, but I'm like, the 100 loop will fall sooner rather than later. I knew it was going to happen. I want to give a quick shout out to Keith Russell, Irish guy, who, as they say in that world, got the assist. He ran 89, I think, yards, so for 596 kilometers-ish. So big shout out to those guys for pushing themselves. So Murphs, right now, with, you know, Miren, as I said, not sure if that's exactly how you pronounce his name. That's what we're going to go with.
Sounds good to me.
Doing 90 laps, and your record, personal record, is 46. Is that right?
Yeah. Yep.
So your personal record, 46, and we will get back onto that. But you won, and you were still feeling pretty good in comparison to, you know, have you done in the past. I want to know, for you going into your next Backyard Ultra, whenever that is, Miren completing 90, like, does that change your outlook on what's possible going into a Backyard Ultra, knowing two people have done 89 and one person has done 90 laps?
It does. Like, it only feels like not that long ago that 100 was that far off number that people threw around, but you weren't really sure if anyone was serious about it actually being a possibility anytime soon. And now all of a sudden we've gone from 68 to 75 to 85 to 90, and just in a matter of 18 months, I think it is. And it's like, it's that that point, like with marathons and the mile and like that, all of a sudden someone hits a mark and all of a sudden that becomes the norm. And then it's someone's got to go do something special and go bigger than that. And then all of a sudden that becomes the norm. I think, especially in this this format, there's still so much growth happening and people figuring out how to run it and how to train for it, that there's, yeah, 100. I wouldn't be surprised if 100 fell this year.
So I know we're sort of a bit fast forward on your journey, but I just because it's such an interesting thing. You know, you talked about the marathon and the mile, like Roger Bannister. That is a massive case study. You know, he broke the, everyone said it was impossible for a human to run under 4 minutes for the mile, 1,609 meters to be exact. And then he did it. And then, you know, his name is now forever in folklore. But I'm pretty sure I did some research and wrote a blog about this years ago for someone else. And I'm pretty sure it was like a month later or 2 weeks later, there was a bunch of people that went out and a couple of them broke 4 minutes. It was just the fact that he did it first. But then now you look at even high school and in college, like, you know, especially in America, there's a bunch of high school kids that can run sub 4 minute mile. Like, that's just mind blowing. So there is this psychological thing that, okay, someone's done it, then, you know, why can't I? So
exactly right.
I'm going to put you on the spot here and I'm going to squeeze it out of you. With Mirren running that, and you've ran, I think, 4 now backyard ultras, and knowing sort of a little bit about it, what it's like, let's say over the next 2 years, right? Because I think that's also helpful for context. Over the next 2 years, what do you think you're capable of running?
Ooh. The current goal is to get the Australian record back, which is 51, which is, we get the right people in the right spot. That's a no-brainer. And everyone has a good day where we'll fly past that. As to where I could get to,
if you've got someone who's willing to just, because obviously this is not just about you, this is about other people, as you said, getting the right people together. You know, everything is fine, like everything's good. It's a day, you know, you're out there running. There's one or two people who are just like showing up every lap. What does Chris Murphy, the ultra runner, you know, think he's like in for a good show? Like, what is it? What is the stretch target that you know, in the back of your mind, you're realistic. If, you know, a few things go your way and you can dig deep, what do you reckon you've got in your legs?
I'd be pushing for 72 plus.
Nice. Like,
that's a big jump from where I am, but. Like a 46, but.
And how would you mentally prepare going into your next, or as I said, we've got a two year period to do that. How would you mentally prepare going into your next race where you're like, right, like my target is 72 hours. Like, how would you mentally prepare going into that, knowing that, okay, I've done 46, but let's rock out 72.
I suppose I'd roll in, set myself up for probably 100, 120 laps with my gear and food and whatever, so that there's no questions that even if I do get to 72 that I stop there. And that'd be part of the mental game that I played myself, was be, all right, I'm here for 100 hours. Whether I'm running or not, I'm here for 100 hours. If I'm going to be here, I might as well keep running. And with my last one, Dead Cow Gully, I know we're probably going to talk about it at some point, but I had a really bad day mentally, and that pulled me up way earlier than I would have liked. So knowing the low that I had during that race and how I managed to keep going and how well I pulled out of that, having had that experience that I can sort of lean on, knowing that no matter how shit I am mentally, that if the body's still moving, the body's still moving, and keep pushing forward with that. And then it'll be obviously having the guys around me to be able to do the run with. So like the likes of Barry Loveday, who I ran that 46 with, he has been training up a storm. He is ready to go. I'd be comfortable knowing we're going to go to 72 with him there. Ryan Crawford is exactly the same. And there's more guys sneaking in through the background that punch down big numbers. And they might be their first or second go at it.
So having that confidence with the people who are at the start line to say, because that, obviously this is a, it sounds odd, but this is a team event.
To do these races.
If you're going for the win, if you're going for big numbers, it's a team event. So having that confidence of the people who are on the start line would also give you confidence in terms of trying to do a big number.
Yep. And like when the first one I did, and when we got to the 46, I did was a slightly different setup, but the first one I did was people would almost start playing games with each other to try and work out where the other person is mentally and try and go, oh, what? They'd have a poker face saying, no, I'm still good. So the other person goes, shit, this bloke's going to go forever. There's no point me going on. I'm not going to win. And there'd be that bit of a game in the background. But now it's turning more to the point where you can't afford to play games because you need this other person to go with you to be able to do the big numbers and do the big games. It's not all just about winning now. It's about winning and setting a big number, because a big number can lead you on to bigger things further down the track in regards to this format now. So,
wow, that's really interesting. Which is cool. So within the races, people are being really vulnerable with how they're feeling. So everyone's like, your competitors are, rather than trying to beat you, are actually trying to support you to keep going, which then would help them because they're going to support, that's going to help them get a bigger number. And also at the same time, you know, as we know with ultra running, if someone's having a really crappy time, it could be an hour or 2 hours later that the roles are reversed.
Yeah, exactly.
So,
right.
So these conversations are happening within the races, are they?
Yeah. So that 46 I did at the Satellite World Championship one for the Australian team, it got down to, I think it was after 30 hours, it was me and Barry Loveday left. And we just said, all right, yep, just work together and do what we can do. And he was like, oh, look, he says, I might get a couple laps more. I'll try and get you through to 33. I'll try and get you through to 36. And I'm like, we're both there. He'd encourage me. I'd have a few shitty laps. He'd have a few shitty laps. And we just try and a bit of encouragement and run with each other as we needed to try and, make sure that we were both getting as far as we could. And the support he gave me was just incredible, and got to the point where he just couldn't fit a slap in time, and he pushed his body beyond anywhere I thought was possible on that day.
I think that's really, and I'm choosing this word consciously, I think that's really beautiful for the human race, and I'll explain that for a second. I think that's really beautiful for the human race, because you can take that into everyday life, you can take that into business, you can take that into anything, where it's, even if you are trying to accomplish something, then your competitors, if you work together, then it's only going to help both of you move forward. Because bottom line, if you try and work together and the other person just like, yeah, thanks for that, and then just drops off, like, it is what it is. But in terms of like the backyard ultras, that means your race is over as well. Or you might not even achieve that potential. But it is that going back and forth with the competitors, but at the same time supporting one another while you're there. So I think it's a really beautiful thing that's evolving in these types of races, in ultra running. And I think, you know, you can translate that into, you know, everyday life in so many different things. And I didn't mean this, but it's a great segue into one of the questions I wanted to ask you, is what is something that you've learned from ultra running that has helped you in your everyday life?
Probably a bit of patience, I guess. When I went from the 5K to the 21K to the 28, yes, I probably did it a bit faster than most, making those jumps up. 2 years between not running and doing 100K, but no, if I do the work day by day, week by week, and take my time and focus, then I can achieve these big things. So it's something I like to think that I'm setting a good example for my kids, that like, you do the hard work now and look at what you can potentially achieve further down the track by not taking the easy route now, doing the hard work, putting in what you need to put in, and it comes out the other end. Also, I suppose understanding how you can go through something that's ridiculously hard that you hate and whatever, and then come out the other side and look back on it and smile, is just because something's hard and hurts and you're miserable doing it, it can be a positive outcome at the other end, I suppose.
Do you have a process or something that you consciously do to when you complete a race or when you complete something that's really tough, that, as you said, to sort of stop and look back at it? Is there something that you consciously do or a process that you go through?
I do tend to try and not necessarily straight away, but a few days afterwards, take five and reflect a little bit on how things went. Because I suppose that curiosity always kicks back in and goes, what could you have done better? There's always multiple things that you go, if I just did this a little bit different, then in the backyard, I could have gone extra few laps, or I could have felt a whole lot more comfortable through that period where I was just dragging my lip around, sulking the whole time.
Yeah, I think it's really important. Like most people's daily life these days in the world that we live in is so fast, right? So fast. And we do a big race, we do a big event at work, let's say, for people that are listening that might not be running ultras, they finish a big project, you know, whatever that is. Or even, you know, you put on a big party for someone, whatever it is, something that you've worked towards to accomplish. And then we're like, oh yeah, we'll think about what worked and what didn't. And they sort of go through the next few days, next weeks, and they might think about it for a second, whether they're driving or on a train or whatever. But I think it's really important for people to create a space in their life. And I mean this in terms of time, to create space to actually stop and not sort of think about it while I'm commuting or doing this or doing that or doing five other things like, you know, us at humans in the 21st century like to do. I think it's really important to actually stop and create space, even put it in your diary, you know, Tuesday, 7 p.m. from 7 till 8 p.m. I'm going to stop and I'm going to think. I'm going to stop and I'm going to write, or book in with a friend. Okay, let's chat, but I want to chat about my race. I want to talk about this project. I want to talk about this party that I put on in terms of what went well, what didn't go well, and how we can make it better, or how I think I can make it better, or alternate it for a second thing. So I think it's really, really great that, as you said, like you actually stop and not straight away. I think it's time to let things settle down, let those emotions die down, to sort of see, what happens. Because like I've completed things that have gone really, really great. And yeah, the next day I'm like buzzing, going, yeah, this is awesome, this is great, this is fantastic, I feel fantastic. But then, you know, 4 or 5 days later, I can see through the rainbow and be like, although I did amazing, there's a couple of things that I could do better. But if I sort of tried to reflect, you know, 48 hours after I finished it, yeah, what's coming to mind is my double Ironman, the double Brutal Extreme Triathlon in North Wales. Like, I still, to this day, it took me 35 nonstop hours. It's one of the funnest weekends I've ever had in my life, even though I completed a mountainous double Ironman. And if you said to me 2 days after the race, like, what could have you done better? I would have said nothing. It was perfect. Now, yeah, like it was a great and amazing race, but there's definitely things I could have done perfect. So whether it went really well, this big project or the party or the race you did, or, you know, like a lot of times, you crash and burn and it went horrible. But then also, even if it just went okay somewhere in the middle, as you said, like it's important to create space, let those emotions drop, and then so you can actually see what you're left with. So
focus on the positives and the negatives too.
Yeah. So tell me, like, give me one example, if you can think of it, where you've looked back on a race. Let's say this, I think it was a Clint Eastwood. No, it was the Clint Eastwood that you won. Was that the one that you won? Yeah.
No, the next one after that was.
Okay. So
Big Backyard Satellite.
And that's right. That was the Big Backyard Satellite. That was the Australian Championship. And, you know, literally the Australian chip, like this, when I first saw this, like, I'm not going to lie, I had this massive smile on my face. I'm like, this guy who I know too is racing in the Australian Championship, the national championships for this crazy, you know, backyard ultra. And he won, and he's the Australian champion. And that's you, Murph, the Australian champion. So after this race, like, you know, there are a lot of positives. You set a big target. You became the Australian champion. You then were able to travel to Tennessee to run in the world championships at Laz's backyard. You don't know who Laz is, you know, Barkley Marathon. You've probably heard of that. He is the man behind this. So let's you know, give us just a quick snapshot of what were the things that you looked at after you became, I love saying this, the Australian champion of the backyard ultra. You know, like talk us through just, you know, real briefly of some of the positive things that you took out of that and then some of the things that you could have done better.
I'd managed to figure out my sleep pattern for that race. So that was one thing that made a really big difference to my race, especially coming from the Clint Eastwood. I struggled early on with sleep in that one. This race, I did a whole lot better with sleep.
I don't want to cut in there, but I think you've got to give context. People are like, oh yeah, okay, yeah, he has a bit of sleep, like, you know, an hour here, hour there. Like, remember, 6.7 kilometers every hour. What sleep strategy did you figure out that was going to work for you in the future before you continue on with your answer?
Yeah, so we started at 10 o'clock at night, I think it was, for that race. So not much sleep during the day. And then I tweaked my lap time, just slowed it down a little bit from my previous. So I was now doing 46-minute loops. So that gave me 14 minutes break before the next lap each time. So that was to eat, drink, change shoes, massage, whatever needed doing, and then squeeze in a bit of sleep as well. So big thanks to the crew. So my wife, Nicole, and a good friend of ours, Julie, they crewed for me at that race. And they just treated me like a child and stuck food in my face, did what they needed to do. And then I'd eat what I could or what I needed to, have a bit more of a drink, and then kick back in the chair, big reclining camp chair, so I could lay out flat and lights out for 4 or 5 minutes and then get woken up by the next whistle.
And most of the time, did you feel like you actually were asleep?
For most times that I tried to sleep, yeah. So during the nights, I'd get a little bit, and then during the day, I tried to sort of stay awake a little bit to try and keep consistent consciousness, I suppose. And then once I'd start to feel tired again, it was, I need to get in what sleep I can. And yeah, it was almost to the point where if I closed my eyes, it was like the whistle was going straight away. So wow. I became quite good at falling asleep just like that. It was good and bad all at once.
Really curious, after you finished the race and you had like the first night where you got into bed and I don't know, like I could imagine that you passed out and properly slept, or I could imagine that you didn't. How long did it take before you felt like you were back on a, let's say normal, for whatever that means, your normal sleep schedule?
It was probably close to a week, I think. Wow. Yeah. I think we started the race Saturday night. I finished Monday night. And then, yeah, we got back to the hotel that night. And I couldn't sleep. Legs were sore and body was all over the place. Head was all over the place. I was still buzzing from the fact that I'd managed to walk away with the gold medal at that one. So that was pretty cool. But and then I did get to sleep, and then I woke up a couple of hours later, and we were supposed to drive home the next day, I think. And we'll plan on taking 2 days to get home. I ended up taking us 4 or 5 days to drive home. We just drive for a few hours and I'm like, nah, we got to stop again. So thankfully my in-laws live up this way now, so they had the kids and were looking after them. So it was lucky in that respect. But yeah, I think we got home later that week, and I was still foggy in the head, like trying to have conversations and whatnot. But yeah, now then, that looking back now, that sort of stuff seems to be a bit more normalized, and that distance doesn't seem as anywhere near as crazy as what it did at the time. And but yeah, it was good fun.
I bet. So I think it's important. Another point to sort of highlight is, as you said, like that distance and the amount of sleep that you're getting, or lack of sleep that you're getting. And I think that highlights how important sleep is to the body and how like a couple of nights restless sleep can actually have a long-term effect. Obviously you're doing something that's extreme, but I think it also highlights things on a daily basis. And it's a great point to make that, you know, it sort of touches on what we said earlier, is that when someone else has done it or someone else is doing it, then, well, why can't I? And that curiosity point comes into it. And and I've said to numerous people, when people said to me, oh, I'm thinking about doing this big challenge, what do you think? And I was just like, well, someone's done it before. They didn't die. So it's a good start. You know, there's obviously, it's obviously possible.
Can be done.
Yeah, it can be done. And I think that that really says something. And that can be translated into, yeah, everyday life or anything. People say, oh, I can't do this, I can't do that because of X, because of Y, because of Z. Well, if it's something that you truly want to do, then yeah, like you might have to make certain choices to help you achieve that. But I think it's a case of, if someone in everyday life wants to achieve whatever it is, whether it's doing their first ultra marathon, doing their first 10K, doing their first 5K like you, starting a business or whatever, then if someone else has done it, then it's, you know, it potentially is possible for you. So with that being said, as you went on, you became Australian champion of the Backyard Ultra, which I think is so cool, and must have been such a big high. Now,
it was still is.
Of course. So then you went into recently, the most recent one that you did, the Dead Cow Gully Backyard Ultra, where I'm going to throw it out there. I'm going to build this up. You know, you've become well known on the Backyard Ultra scene in Australia, obviously being the Australian champion and at one stage holding the Australian record for the amount of loops. And I followed, obviously, you know, follow you along, and I knew you were doing this. And, you know, the race organizers put out their top five list of who they expect to go the longest, and you came in at number two. So I was like, yeah, cool. You know, I'm going to watch Murphs, and if things go well, like, you know, he could be up there for the end. So the first question, I'm just setting that up for a later question, but the first question is, did anything change mentally in the preparation for the Dead Cow Gully to, say, the Australian championship that you won?
Yeah, I guess going into the Australian Championship one, I was probably, if I was going to rank myself anywhere in that, I was going to rank myself 15th out of 15. The rest of the runners in that team were Australian representatives for 24, 48-hour teams and all that sort of thing, and with ridiculous resumes. And I was like, wow, these guys are proper runners. And I'll just go along, learn what I can, see what they do, how they do, pick their brains, and I'll just hang on as long as I can. And then I'll go home with a bit more, a few more ideas under my belt to be able to learn from. And that's what I was aiming for, the Australian Championship one. And to turn around and win that was a big shock. And then coming into Dead Cow Gully, obviously, like you said, I was number two on the top five, expected to run big at that race. And I was expecting to go reasonably big. I know I've been in touch with Barry and Ryan and Tim, the race director. It was looking like a race that was going to go really big. The guys, people have been training for it. We had multiple people there that had potential to go really long.
And when you say really long, did anyone throw out numbers, or it was just a case of, we're ready to go several days?
We were setting up to go for the Australian record, which is 51. So a guy by the name of Phil Gore, so West Australian, he took the record off me, put it to 48, and then he put it to 50, and then he's put it to 51. So he's consistently setting the standard on that side of the country. And so we had that as our first goal. And then a few of them were talking 60 or 70. So
fine.
We had people there that were aiming big, and then had the training under their belt and the mentality to back it up, really.
So
I wasn't sure how I was going. This year has been rough for me. Consistency wise is the biggest thing for me. So had COVID back in January, and just life basically between since then. So it is what it is. I was feeling comfortable in the body. I hadn't done any major massive training or whatever, but I was feeling good. Mentally, I was in a really good headspace. I'm like, yep, no, I'm ready to just run and just keep running. About 15 hours in, I got a little bit of a pain in my knee. And then from that point, that's all I could focus on.
So in the past, when like you've got a specific pain or when there's been a specific issue, in the past, how have you been able to move past that and remove that out of your, you know, smack bang view front and center?
Normally it's just like, yep, you're running a long way. Things are going to start hurting. Things are going to be painful. It's to be expected. And normally it just blends into the overall pain of and so background noise of what you're doing.
So why was Dead Cow's situation different?
I think my lack of consistency was chirping in the background that, oh, your knee's hurting because you haven't done the proper training that you wanted to do. Your knees aren't up for the task, what we're doing today. And it was that negative talk in the back of my mind that just was louder than anything else for I don't know why. And in hindsight, it really bugs me that I let that win. But
so how would, in hindsight, looking back at now, what are some things that, and I'm not going to say that you would do different in the moment, because I think, you know, you've got the tools that you've got at that moment, but what are some of the things that you would potentially do prior to going into your next race to try and help you if those negative voices were quite loud in future races?
I'm probably going to have a sit down session rather with the coach or just by myself going through, right, what could go wrong? And when list them out, and when A goes wrong, I'm going to do X. If this goes wrong, I'm going to do Y. And have that plan in place before going into the race and go, right, if I know I'm middle of the night, something's annoying me and I'm getting sad and I'm just sulking, do you need more sleep? Do you need to bang in some caffeine? Do you just need a bit of tough love and get slapped around or something stupid to just snap you out of it? And I think that's where I probably could have done a little bit differently. It was probably a bit more caffeine and just jerk myself back up a little. But yeah, so that'll be something I'll do a bit more seriously next time, is plan out all the different potential things that can go wrong and have a planned response to each of those going in, so I don't have to think.
It always eludes me, the actual scientific term for it. But there's been loads of studies on that. And the last one I read from memory, it was basically talking about if this, then that. So if this happens, then I do that. If this happens, then I do that. And like, there are a bunch of, as I said, I can't remember the actual scientific literature's phrase for it, but there has been numerous studies that where prior to doing a project, whether it's a ultra marathon or whatever, it's if you go through and you just sort of list of all these things, if this happens, then I do that. And the people who have been most successful from this, in my memory from reading a bunch of these studies, is the ones that look at the things that could go negative, obviously, because you want to overcome the negative things, but also when things go really right. So if I do feel really good at this point, then I do that. And that might just be, that is, I do the same thing that I've been doing. That might be I slow down. That might be I go faster. That might be I take on more fuel now because I do feel good. So it's really helpful, and it's really great that you've been able to sort of look at that. So yeah, I would encourage you to not only look at the things that could go wrong, but also look at some things that, you know, if they do go right, then what are the things that I focus on as well? What do I change it? Do I tweak it, or do I just do the same? Because then you're consciously saying, you're consciously being self-aware of yourself and also the situation. So I think, mate, that well done to you for coming up with the process to go through to help you pull out some positive things. And Was there anything else that you learned from your experience at the Dead Cow Gully as well?
No, it's just more of the same, really, that on that same sort of vein as that, is that the more you can plan and have in place ready to go, the less decisions you have to make along the way. Because once you get past that 24-hour mark, that your decision-making abilities are really hindered. So if you've got all those decisions made, or 99% of the decisions made before you even get there, then that just makes you're just executing a plan as opposed to problem solving, I guess.
I love that. I think that's a great way to finish, Murphs. The more you plan, the less decisions you need to make. And that is helpful in not just running ultras and preparing for them, but also I think in everyday life. Murphs, it's been fantastic to chat. Thanks, buddy.
Good to see you again, man.
You too. Firstly, I want to ask you, are you coming to Europe this year to do TDS?
Funny you should say that, because I booked my flights to Paris this morning.
Love it. All right. We've got to chat. We will chat. We will chat after the episode. But awesome. So
yes, I'll be there in August.
Cool. So this episode will come out before then. So this is 2022 for all those who are listening in the future. So definitely check out Chris Murphy running the TDS, part of UTMB's race week. So definitely, you know, put him on your favorites box to check. And if people want to follow you from now until then, see your progress and see what you're up to, mate, where can people find you? Or if they've got any questions, where can they come and ask them?
Probably easiest is on Instagram, I think. So C Murphy Run. I am on Facebook, but don't do a whole lot on there. But yeah.
So, fantastic. Yeah. All right, mate. I want to say a massive thanks for spending some time with me today. A lot of gratitude for you taking the time. I know you're a busy man. You've been working hard and with having Nicole and the kids as well coming into the weekend. So Murphs, thank you very much for being a guest on the Luke's Lowdown podcast.
I appreciate it, man. Thanks for having me on.
All right, everyone. That is a wrap. That is the end of this series of the Luke's Lowdown podcast. I tell you what, I've learned so much. I think I'm going to do another episode maybe next week or a couple of weeks to share with you the key takeaways that I've learned personally and how I'm going to apply them, not only in my training and my racing, but also in my everyday life. I want to thank all of the listeners out there who have liked, subscribed, and shared it. I've had so many messages from every single podcast that I've put out there. So thank you, everyone, for tuning in to the Luke's Lowdown podcast, and look out for another series coming at the end of 2022. Keep it real, keep getting after it, and thanks very much, everyone.